You're listening to In the Vault, a KPMG banking industry podcast series.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Liz Lamadou, a principal in KPMG's Banking and Capital Markets Tax Practice. And today I'm joined by my banking colleague, Paul Lorries, who's a managing director in our practice. Welcome, Paul.
Hey, Liz. Great to be here with you today.
Glad you could make it. So today we're going to talk about a new provision from this summer's OB3 legislation, and that is the ACRES provision. So high level, this provision provides that 25% of the interest income on certain real property loans is exempt from tax. So on the surface, that sounds pretty straightforward. Paul, I think you're going to tell us that there's lots of complexities in here, and it's not quite as straightforward as it seems. So we'll spend the next several minutes talking through the provision, including what we know, and also what questions we still have, and we may need some regs to help us resolve those questions. So, Paul, why don't we start at the beginning? Tell us about the new provision.
Yeah, so this is an interesting new provision that, as you stated, allows 25% exclusion of interest received on agricultural loans by a qualified lender, qualified loan. So as you can imagine, typical with tax law, there's a lot of definitions involved here. Probably the first definition that really need to dig into there a little bit was just the whole concept of what is a qualified lender. And that's pretty important for our bank clients because that's the first one is a bank or savings and loan institution that's regulated by the FDIC and insurance on deposits.
So that seems straightforward for a bank to qualify.
Yeah, that part is. And then it also includes insurance companies. And then has some language and definitions around potential inclusion of foreign bank subsidiaries that are entities within the United States, principal place of business is in the United States, as well as their organizational documents.
So what I don't hear is bank subsidiary. So that's an important thing to note when we're talking about a qualifying lender.
Yeah, that's right. For the subsidiaries of a foreign bank holding company, it isn't completely clear how it qualifies for bank subsidiaries, but that's probably something we'll need to get some further guidance on through Treasury and the IRS.
So if we start with one of the definitions of a qualified lender, and that is a bank within the U.S. That takes deposits. Now, what kinds of loans qualify for this?
Yeah, so that's probably the next key definition is it's loan secured by a rural or agricultural real estate mortgage. So important thing is that there's a lien on the property. It also has to be after the date of enactment, which was July 4th of this year.
Okay, so loan secured by rural or agricultural real estate, and then the property has to be the security for the loan. The security piece, I think, sounds pretty straightforward, but how about the rural or agricultural? Like, how do we define that for purposes of the qualified real estate?
Yeah, great question. It's use in the production of ag products or in the business of fishing or seafood processing. And then it goes on to also say, which is related to seafood processing, is aquacultural facilities, which would be structures used such as hatcheries, rearing ponds, and raceways. And then probably one other important fact there in the definition, Liz, is that all that property has to be located in the U.S. or a possession of the U.S. So very domestic focused.
Yeah, that makes sense. So real property, so substantially used for production of one or more agricultural products. So farmland that's growing a crop seems like one of the more basic things that would qualify for this. Is there anything else you can think of that might not be quite as straightforward as the acres actually growing the crop?
Well, the again, that has to be the collateral for the loan. And then it's a matter of how the farmer or borrower is going to use the proceeds. But yeah, the whole area of fishing and seafood and all of the aquacultural stuff is very, very interesting and maybe not something that germane necessarily is somebody like myself that lives in the Midwest. But, you know, row crops, acreages is probably the most that we're going to see here with most of our Midwest-based clients.
That makes sense. And the qualifying property has to secure the loan. But I didn't hear you say anything about how the proceeds of that loan, have to be used that affects the qualification?
That's where it gets kind of interesting, right, Liz? Because the focus here for the banks and the qualified lenders is going to be what's the security of the property to qualify for this exclusion. And then I guess on the other side, the borrower is, you know, how are they going to secure a deduction for the interest incurred to the extent that they use the proceeds for a qualified business purpose, or whether they use it for something personally, you know, to go buy a new car or something to that effect. So it's a little bit of a tracing rule for the borrowers. And then the on the lender side, it's what the collateral is. And then there's probably another interesting provision, which is maybe where you were going to go, Nick, anyway, but the whole concept of what qualifies and after date of enactment, and if it might be considered a refinancing.
Okay, that's really interesting, Paul. So why don't we unpack that with a couple examples? So from the bank perspective, from the lender's perspective, it matters what property is securing the loan for purposes of determining if it qualifies for this 25% exemption. So as long as it is secured by the property, the bank or lender's not concerned what the purpose of the funds or how the funds are used. You're saying, though, on the payor side, though, whether or not they can deduct the interest they're paying to the bank is a different story, whether or not they have a valid business expense. So we could have a loan that qualifies for this exemption on the bank side, but if the borrower uses it to pay for a car or a college tuition, it may not be a business expense, but that has nothing to do with the bank's exemption.
That's right.
Okay. Very interesting.
Yeah, it is. And I guess we hear from clients that they often use the term cross-collateralization. So they would have the land and maybe some other collateral for a loan as well, depending on the facts of the situation. So as an example, if a farmer came in to borrow some funds and secure land, and then also was going to go out and buy a new tractor or a new combine, the bank would often cross-collateralize, meaning both the real estate and the purchased combine or tractor.
Oh, in which case part of the loan might qualify under this provision, but not necessarily all of it.
That's right.
I can see some complexities there for the banks who do want to cross-collateralize and get as much collateral as possible, but that could impact then what piece is subject to exemption.
Yeah, and that might be one that'll be interesting to see if there is some further guidance on that too, right, Liz? Because what do you look at first? Do you look at the real estate first? Do you do it pro rata? What will be the government's expectations around that?
Yeah, good point. So that does seem like something that they could flesh out in the regs to help us with those computations. Okay, so we care what property is securing the loan. From the lender perspective, it doesn't matter how the funds are used. Is there anything else that the lender needs to consider for what type of loan it is?
Yeah, the government was really focused on stimulus with this to stimulate new activity and new borrowings or new transactions associated with ownership of farmland and other farming-related real property. So that can be impactful if a farmer is going to just refinance an existing loan, hopefully to get a better rate. To the extent that it's a refinancing, that's not going to qualify. So it has to be some new activity. And if it's just going to be for, you know, if they had a $100,000 loan on an existing property and they went and got another $100,000 loan and just paid off the other one but got a better interest rate, unfortunately for the lending bank, that's not necessarily going to be considered a new loan that qualifies for this provision.
And do we have any other information on that? Or this may be another topic for regs, but it seemed like does it matter if it's the same amount refinanced with the same institution, or have they defined refinancing for purposes of this provision?
Yeah, it's not exactly clear, but if you think about the mortgage business, typically when somebody refinances a loan, the lender is going to be aware of that because of the mortgage or the lien on the property that they'll be able to confirm with county or city records. So they'll know whether they're in the first position with a new mortgage or not. So I think it's a little broader than just going from bank A to bank B. If it's the use of the proceeds there to refinance an existing mortgage, and that puts the new bank in position A, so to speak, related to the collateral, then that's going to be viewed as a refinancing.
Yeah. As long as there is an outstanding loan on the property, a new loan on the same property sounds like a refinancing.
Yeah. But even that might need some clarification, right, Liz? Because in my example, there is $100,000. Well, let's say when they go to the other bank, they, you know, the value of the property has gone up and they get some other needs in their business. So they can get a $200,000 loan now. So the only part of that that would should, in theory, be a refinancing will be the first $100,000 that was still outstanding on the old loan. And then the additional $100,000, at least in theory, should be considered new money and collateralized by this real estate and be qualified interest. So another nuance with the whole concept of refinancing is you get the details on the underlying loans, right?
Yeah, that's right. And then if I think about the lenders and what they need to do operationally, that's also a lot of detail to understand and track for purposes of determining what piece of a loan's interest might be subject to exemption.
Yeah, I think that's where this is going to get really interesting operationally is getting that data and understanding that. And it's one thing if it's 10 loans, right? But if it's 1,000 loans or hundreds of thousands of loans, that's a lot of information to parse through to really get a good understanding of what's going to qualify here in 2025 with any loans made after July 4th of 2025. I guess the good news is there are at least a couple things that help get you started with assuming your data is good in the sense of collateral codes for your call report. For a bank, there's a couple of call reports items that are addressed specifically to loans secured by farmland or loans to finance agricultural production. So certainly the first one you would think would have mortgages on farmland, and the second one may or may not have some of the qualified information depending on how that's sorted.
That is a helpful hint. I like that. And what other nuances to this provision? Because I want to talk about 265 for a second, because now the bank is getting tax-exempt interest, at least 25% of a particular loan could be tax-exempt. And so normally when we have tax-exempt interest, we have to look to what expense we might be taking for interest paid, interest expense, and make sure we're not deducting anything expense that's related to tax-exempt income. So is there guidance on what we do for TEFRA or 265, Paul?
There is, Liz. There is coordination with 265 included with this provision. And what the inclusion said was that you include 25% of the loan balance in the TEFRA calculation for banks that are following the so-called bank-specific rule under 265B. And then it also had a provision under the 265A rule, which is more of the direct tracing rule. So if there are borrowings that are made from whatever source, Federal Home Loan Bank, other sources, and that those funds are used for origination of these types of loans, then that interest would be considered, or at least 25% of that interest would be considered disallowed associated with these. So very similar to what happens with the ownership of municipal securities, where you have interest disallowance associated with that type of income to the extent that there are borrowings associated with it under the direct tracing rule or the pro rata method under the bank rule under 265B.
Gotcha. Right. So direct tracing under 265A first, then for loans held by the bank, the pro rata method under 265B. So that's helpful that they laid out that you just count 25% of that loan, essentially the same as a tax-exempt security.
As well as 25% of the related interest in under the A rule.
Yes. All right. So we did get some guidance around some things.
I think that's right. We would expect some more guidance around that because it's not very clear on a couple of versions whether how it would actually apply to something that might be viewed as a small issuance, similar to a rule that is out there for small issuances on the municipal side.
Right. And you're speaking about the bank qualified.
That's right.
Yeah, I can see where sometimes in some cases the borrower may be a size that fits under the small issue exception, but absent guidance to specifically trace that, that's a open question, I guess.
I think that's right. That's what I was seeing in the language that they've included in the statute to this point was they only referenced a couple of provisions, and the provisions that were referenced make no corollary to the small issuance guidance for qualified small issuances for municipals.
So another thing we'll look for the regs to help us out with.
Exactly.
Paul, what are you hearing from clients and from bankers about this provision and how it is impacting their business, if at all?
Yeah, so far it's been just a lot of questions, right? Just trying to really get understanding of what qualifies, what doesn't, how to apply this, the application of the interest disallowance to try to think through how it impacts pricing. But I mean, the whole provision is really interesting since it's only 25% interest being excluded. I think there was hope from the industry that this would be a little broader provision with the idea that it made them a little more competitive with Farm Credit Services. But the provision ended up getting scaled down as it made its way through and, 25% rather than some larger percentage of the interest. So I've heard from a few clients trying to figure out how to work this into their pricing for the loans. I've had others say that this isn't a big enough part of their business that they think it's going to have a significant impact. So it's kind of all over the board right now.
And how are clients approaching the data gathering aspects of this? Because we've talked about a couple different things where you're going to have to get pretty granular into some data points to compute the benefit of this.
Yeah, I think that's going to make the conversation with the business people and the tax department just be a little bit more, is the benefit worth the cost of getting into all that data?
Yep, that's right. And if it's a sizable piece of the business, is it worth setting up systems that handle it separately, right? That some way to segregate these so that you know the population you're running these calculations on?
Yeah, and like a lot of things, it'll get easier as we go forward, right? Because this July 4th date and being applicable here for, call it essentially the last half of 2025, but watching out for the refinancing, as you get down the road a few more years, we'll probably get away from some of those, I'll call them cutoff considerations that might not be quite as prevalent as they're going to be for this year, maybe on into 2026 at some level. And then I think it also depends on whether some of the states piggyback on this. I guess I'll throw out that the state of Kansas put a similar provision in a few years back already. It wasn't just meant to be stimulative because they were allowing the banks to look back too. And so that was a little bit easier to get to the data for some of our clients that do business in Kansas and have those loans secured by property in Kansas, to get to what the interest was associated with those kind of qualified loans. So point being is that some of those are already doing it in certain states. So if you got a reason for your state taxes and now you have a reason to have it for your federal taxes, well, it makes it a little bit more worthwhile to dig into the data and get what you need to reduce those tax obligations.
That's a great point. And to be honest, I hadn't even thought about the state aspect of this and whether some states may adopt this and now I've learned that some states already have although maybe a slightly different fashion.
Yeah. And then what they do with typical conformity with federal law and certain things, right? So will they consider this like municipal? So you have to put it in your state modifications or will they follow through on that for depending on how significant the ag industry is to their economy and follow suit at the state level?
Yes. Also great points and more complexities to be figured out. Another thing to watch for federal conformity as well. OB3 had its share of those. So, Paul, these are some really great insights about this provision. Thanks for talking me through this and sharing what you know. I definitely think it's worth another conversation when we get some regulations on this and we can talk through where we might know more. So I look forward to having you back and we can discuss this as it unfolds. And to our audience, thank you for joining us today. This is Liz Lamadou on behalf of KPMG's Banking and Capital Markets Tax Practice. I look forward to talking again soon.
Thanks for listening to In the Vault with KPMG. Be sure to subscribe to this series to be notified of new episodes.